Here we are. We just finished contemplation, listening to some music, and following our breath. The music was something we recorded and produced about 20 years ago with Oruç Güvenç and some other Turkish musicians. And it's an example of Sufi music therapy. A little bit of water in the background. Water is one of the instruments. And it was in what's called Rast Makam, which is a very generally healing scale. So anyway, it was just a prop for your breath, something to focus on. Simultaneously, breath and music, in order to engage us fully in the moment and take us beyond thought, beyond our conventional emotions, our habitual patterns, and if we were to try to give a short glimpse into how we understand spirituality and Sufism in particular, we could say, for instance, that it's a discipline, a practice, a process for taking us beyond the limitations of the thinking mind and the habitual emotions. Most human activities, even religious activities, the light on better, I think, even some spiritual activities fill the mind. They give information, knowledge, moral instruction and encouragement. They put things into the mind. And we do that to some extent because there are certain sort of principles and matters of character and respect and affection and friendship that are, in a way, the ground rules for a healthy community. But given that context being established, then the real work is something else. The real work has to do with taking us beyond our thinking mind, beyond the emotions and desires, likes and dislikes of the self, to another realm of experience. And thought is useful in its own domain. It's useful for figuring out insurance claims and, you know, planning a budget and things like this. But when it comes to grasping spiritual reality, it's not very useful, and in fact can be a problem if we mistake the information we get, or even the things we read from the mystics, and if we just settle on the words, the concepts, and fill ourselves with those concepts. We are, as Rumi would say, just like a donkey with a big load of books on our back. The real process is to take that knowledge and let it guide us or open us to the realities that the language is speaking about. And I'll give you an example, a really practical example. One might easily miss the point of this. So each month we have a theme. This month the theme, and it's on the website, sufism.org, the theme for October is a saying from the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. When two believers, and actually I like the word faithful, but, you know, believers, we don't mean people who believe, but people who have a spiritual quest. When two believers support each other, it's like two hands washing one another. Now, on one level, it's moral advice, but we could just say support each other. Be good to each other. You better be good to each other. You know, we could preach. But here in this beautiful hadith, it's saying two believers who support each other are like two hands that wash each other. So it's pointing to something. Those two hands, at least as I read it, are two hands of the same being, not one of your hands and one of my hands. That wouldn't be a very practical way to wash. So there's something being pointed at, you know, beyond the moralizing of it. And the Prophet, peace be upon him, was pointing to a reality that was not just, you know, moralizing about you better be good, you better be good, you better be good. And moralizing like that hasn't done a whole lot for humanity. Anyway, so coming back to the main point, which is the essence of spirituality as we understand it, to glimpse the spiritual realities that the soul needs to know and longs to know, the very first step, or among the first steps, are quieting the mind and stilling the emotions, or moving beyond these, moving to another state of being that is transcends those or can at least observe them, and where we can experience thought and feelings from a vantage point that's other than those thoughts and emotions. It's extraordinary how much human beings live in a very tight box of thinking and feeling, and all of those thoughts and feelings being generated by an I, or we think it's an I, we think it's me, we have an idea, a person has an idea of who they are based on what they've been told by their parents in the beginning, and an identity that is formed and is made mostly of thoughts about ourselves, and they might be things like, well, you're a good boy, you're a good girl, or you're not such a good boy, or you're not such a good girl, or you would be a good boy or girl if you did this. So you're trying to do all those things, and you have a memory of the past, and you're thinking about your past, and you're thinking about your future, and you have this constructed identity, and it's all contained in a box, which is a box of thought, thinking, and it's a tight box, it has to be, it's full of contradictions. In today's world, it's you know, full of information and contradictions, and it's crowded with desires, needs, responsibilities, all of this stuff in that box which you think is yourself. And really, for in this society at this time, in this culture and world at this time, where people live primarily in urban environments and we engage with artificialities, with machines and technologies most of the time, this is where we are, this is what we're doing, we're not pastoral people, we're not generally people living in the midst of nature and having nature as our mirror, or having the natural processes as our environment. We have an artificial environment, we have pressures, we have time constraints, and we have this identity that we take to be ourselves without ever, and I hate to use this, perpetuate this cliche of stepping out of the box. It's embarrassing to even say that, but nevertheless, it is a box. It's a prison. Or if you like, it's a jar or a tight bottle. In spirituality, in various ways, in true spirituality and in true Sufism, we are putting the mind, the thinking mind, in its place, letting our emotions become a bit more still, letting our whole being become, for a while at least, quieter, in order to open up to something else, to open up to, it's going to sound abstract, but to open up to the reality of being, to open up to what is. And another important aspect of this is to open up to it in such a way, and when I say open up to being, I don't mean open up to some abstract, impersonal experience of white light. I mean just open up to what is right in front of us right now, wherever we are, whatever's happening. And to experience this without too much labeling, without imposing a story on it, without writing a story about what it means, which is another thing that human beings habitually do. Something happens to us and suddenly we're writing what the meaning is, like, oh, this means I'm a bad person, or this means I'm a very important person, or this means, you know, whatever we feel the need to, you know, whatever narrative we habitually will write on our experience, or we'll look at what other people are doing and we'll say, they're just doing what they're doing, but then we put a meaning on it, which may not be their meaning, their intention, it's our meaning, it's our interpretation of what's going on. And this is all constructs of the mind that in fact are far from the divine reality, are far from the grace of God, and far from the intrinsic love which is the very nature of reality. In fact, most of the time, the narratives we write, the meanings we assign, are not very positive. Unless we've been educated otherwise, unless we have been perhaps taken to heart some principles that have come from a higher source, principles such as be grateful for what is. Always be grateful. Forgive. Don't judge. Don't blame. Don't complain. Spiritual principles, which still, when they're only at the level of thought, are very limited in their value and their effect, but at least a thought like this, there are some beautiful words of the prophets and the saints that actually transform our perception. Certainly the words of Rumi are that way. So many of the words enter deep into the heart and begin to transform how we see things. Thanks be to God. But their value is not as information in our memory. Their value is in what they do to our perception. Rumi says, for instance, water says to the dirty one, come. Dirty one says, but I'm so ashamed. Water says, but how will you become clean without me? And right there we have a sense of our human condition, our egoism, our self-denigration, our shame, our guilt. And then we're also informed about the water, that there's also water exists, and water cleanses. And there's a water that is the water of reality, the water of life, the water of grace, the water of mercy. You do well to be washed by it. An idea like that enters deep enough into our hearts, and a whole layers of shame and negativity may be washed away. But coming back to the essence of what we're trying to focus on right now is the absolute importance of stepping outside the thinking mind, the reactive and contradictory emotions, into another state of being, into another level of consciousness, into another part of your mind, if you like, another dimension of your soul might be more accurate, and cultivating that with a gentle discipline, moment by moment, day by day, year by year, until one begins to live in that state more constantly. And then, ideally, what is what is. And either you learn to trust reality or not. At least you're not, you know, fantasizing a reality and creating a false reality. Or a false self. There is a possibility of awakening a pure state of being that is yourself, that you experience as yourself, but not as a self that's a mere thought, not a self that is a construct of the mind, but a self that is pure witnessing, pure being, and therefore a self that is being guided by, informed by, a greater intelligence. So we have these two choices in front of us. One choice is to continue being imprisoned in the world of thinking and habitual emotions, and a habitual I that is a construct of our thoughts and what people told us we are, especially our parents and our society, and our living projecting into the future and in remembering the past of who we think we are, and judging ourselves, blaming ourselves, experiencing inner contradictions of ourselves. Also, we might add the fact that so much of the input into our lives, which comes from media manufactured by, you know what, by commercial, political, and or falsely religious institutions that have a need to control us, manipulate us, continually bombarded with material of that sort. How will the soul withstand this? How will the soul know itself apart from all of this? Not just by reacting to it and saying it's bad, but by developing a capacity of being that simply is, and that experiences itself as a part of greater being, experiences itself as one with a wider field of being, and yet individualized, and yet in relationship, having a self that can be responsible and functional and think and do things with the thinking mind when it's appropriate, but not to be limited by those faculties, instead to literally open up the aperture of consciousness so that we could directly experience the spiritual nature of reality. Do we doubt that? Anyone sitting in this room right now must surely know that fundamentally this reality is spiritual in nature. But how often do we actually experience it. I hope often. Potentially, it could be continuous. The nature of reality, the reality which is totally manifest by divine intelligence, divine grace, all of it, everything. Where else does it come from? Except for little fears and ripples of negativity that human beings add to it, which in the end are still taken up into this overwhelming grace and mercy and put to use just as like kind of fertilizer in the great fields of being. Meanwhile, the mystics are cultivating the fields of God's grace, and they're seeing that this is what we're in. We're in the fields of God's grace, nothing but that. Therefore, we see each other in that light, and we see each other as that, and we see each other as soul. Coming back to the hadith again. When two believers support each other, it's like two hands washing one another. Well, can you experience that? How would you experience that? It's very nice as a thought. It's a good moral thought. But to actually experience that, your friendship and support of your friend is no different than hands washing each other. There's a unity there, there's a cooperation. There's, it was once said, I'm not sure if it was a hadith or it was said about the prophet, it could be said about any prophet, but that a prophet cleanses his community as if it were his own body. He doesn't see, if he sees a fault, if he sees something negative out there, the wish is to, somehow cleanse it, not judge it, not fight it, but cleanse it. As if I would cleanse my own feet when they're dirty, or my hands, or my ears, or my hair. This is just, a prophet's being is big enough to do that. Prophet is not one. They said of the prophet Abraham in the Quran that Abraham was a multitude. The being, literally the being of a great spiritual figure, goes far beyond their individuality and actually harmonizes, brings coherence among a whole community or a whole nation or among centuries of souls. That's the power and nature of the soul when it's in contact with reality, when it's in contact with the universe of grace. So recently we've been considering, 2 weeks ago when we were last here, we spoke about being a friend of God. We spoke about the concept of walaya, as it's called in Arabic. And we shared some thoughts on that, and we're still reflecting on that. What is it, for those of you who weren't here, the concept of, if you like, sanctity or holiness in our tradition is a little different. It's expressed differently than it is with words like sanctity and holiness. It's expressed in terms of nearness. The friend of God is the one who's near, or my friend is the one who's near to me. To be a friend of God is to be near to God. But there's also the, even more importantly, the other side of it, which is that God is also the wali. God is the friend. We may strive to be his friend, but he already is our friend. And the grace, the beneficence of al-wali, the divine friend, the divine supporter, is manifested in things like nature, including human nature and all the beautiful qualities of human nature, including the presence of guidance and prophethood throughout history, and even in terms of hardships. and tests that we face in life, which we think are, you know, at first we want to shirk from them and avoid any kind of difficulty or hardship, until with enough experience and maturity we begin to realize that even these hardships are signs of the guidance and benevolence of the friend, of Wali. So there are two sides to this. The divine being near to us being one side, and the other side being our possibility of being near, intentionally, consciously, near to the divine. Which is not accomplished by pouring or stuffing lots of information into ourselves. It's not even memorizing lots of Quran and knowing lots of Rumi. Actually, if we were sincere and we had the right learning attitude, a little would take us a long, long way. You know, a page or two of Rumi, a page or two of revelation of the Quran, you know, is more than enough to carry a human being very far if we had the learning attitude. If we were not just mere passive consumers of information, but if we took any of this to heart. A few words. Words as simple as, indeed, in the remembrance of God, hearts find rest. Huge knowledge and guidance in those few words. Indeed, in the remembrance of God, hearts find tranquility or rest or peace. One of the most valuable packets of knowledge a human being could possibly receive. Now I'm going to give you a mega dose of sanctity in the words of Abdullah Ansari of Herat, 11th century. I didn't have these last week. I've added them to my little list of beautiful descriptions of walaya, nearness to God. Also known, or the awliya, we use the word awliya, the friends of God. This is really an earful, prepare yourself. But see if you can understand it in terms of some of the things we've just spoken about. Not mere words, but we'll try to get a sense of the reality behind these words. And maybe I'll read it once, and then Camille, it'd be beautiful to hear you read it. So Khwaja Abdullah Ansari from Herat. Herat is a beautiful city in Afghanistan, even today. A city of many, many saints, shrines, many, many Sufi shrines. They're everywhere in Herat. Here we go. The friends of God are divers for pearls of wisdom in the oceans of the sciences of reality. They are the sign of devotion in the heavens of primordial human nature that is established permanently in the testament of divine favor. Honored in God's presence, treasures of divine mysteries, superscribed by the law, being themselves the demonstration of divine reality. The lineage of Muhammad in the realm of spiritual truths is resuscitated through them. The way of righteousness constant through their firm-footedness. Their outward character is adorned with the prescriptions of the law. Their inner being illuminated with the luminous jewel of spiritual poverty. The sign of the friend of God is that he or she is the very substance of holy reverence from head to foot. His or her eyes are, as it were, painted with reverence, so that he or she does not gaze on anything inappropriate. His tongue is fettered by courtesy, so that he never speaks a frivolous word. Her foot is shackled by divine reality, so that she does not, I should say, his foot is shackled by divine reality, so that he does not wantonly gad about to court each place of fortune or fortune. His limbs are bound with the bonds of servitude, so that he does not gird his loins except in the service of truth. I was trying to mix up the pronouns a little bit, but then I didn't want to shackle the foot of a woman. That was not appropriate. Better to shackle a man. Would you read this to us? Men need shackling more than women do.
So, the friends of God are divers for pearls of wisdom in the oceans of the sciences of reality. They are the sign of devotion in the heavens of primordial human nature that is established permanently in the testament of divine favor, honored in God's presence. Treasurers of divine mysteries, superscribed by the law, being themselves the demonstration of divine reality. The lineage of Muhammad in the realm of spiritual truths is resuscitated through them. The way of righteousness constant through their firm-footedness. Their outward character is adorned with the principles of the law, their inner being illuminated with the luminous jewel of spiritual poverty. The sign of the friend of God is that he or she is the very substance of holy reverence from head to foot. His or her eyes are, as it were, painted with reverence, so that he or she does not gaze on anything improper. And that one's tongue is fettered by courtesy, so that he or she never speaks a frivolous word. And his or her foot is shackled by divine reality, so that he or she does not wantonly gad abroad to court each place or fortune. His or her limbs are bound with the bonds of servitude, so that he or she does not gird his or her loins except in the service of truth.
People don't speak this way anymore, do they? Mm-hmm. 11th century. But this is not idle preaching, you know. Abdullah Ansari and his life and his words. He had a right to say these things, as few human beings do. So the friends, the Aulia, are divers for pearls of wisdom in the oceans of the sciences of reality. They are the sign of devotion. The sign of devotion in the heavens of primordial human nature. Beautiful concept. That primordial human nature was established in the testament, or you could say the covenant of divine favor or blessing. And they are honored in God's presence, the treasurers of divine mysteries, and being themselves the demonstration of divine reality, as every human being should be and is. So we get the connection, we sense the connection that it's possible for a human being to be express the favor of God, express the grace of God. And the lineage of Muhammad in the realm of spiritual truth is resuscitated through them. The way of righteousness constant through their firm-footedness. Their outward character is adorned with the principles of the law. Their inner being illuminated, here it is, with the luminous jewel of spiritual poverty. Their inner being. Says it very nicely. Not their inner being is full of encyclopedic information of the saying of the religious scholars. No, their inner being is illuminated with the pearl of spiritual poverty. And they're the very substance of holy reverence from head to foot. Their eyes are painted with reverence. And they don't just look at anything. Even their senses are under their control. And their tongue is governed by courtesy. Not even a frivolous word. And they don't get about to court each place or fortune. And their limbs are bound in servanthood. And they don't gird their loins except in the service of truth. So I always realize when I'm reading something about this, this is way much higher level than any of us know. Or are, but nevertheless, we have some glimpse, something to inspire us a little bit, something to awaken us. Some human being in Herat, in Afghanistan, 1,000 years ago, saw things this way and saw human possibilities like this. And what we're proposing is that these attainments are, while in this form, very, very exalted, very, very high, but at the same time, the possibilities for each of us, possibilities of stepping outside the limitations of our habitual thoughts and feelings and opening pure-heartedly to simply what is, cleansing our hearts, cleansing our minds, reserving some of our attention for that possibility and that state that is always here, always right in front of us, always calling us. It's what we're meant to know. It's what we've been given this equipment for, this equipment of our human consciousness, our human heart, our nervous system, all of our faculties. We have faculties to know all of this. It's not exclusively for the one in a million prophets or saints. Those one in a million prophets and saints came to tell us that this is also for us. To whatever extent is our portion, to whatever extent is our capacity. And if we would just fulfill what capacity is truly ours, it would be an extraordinary potential. And that's why we breathe, that's why we do the practices we do. And also must understand that if we do our practices, such as Salah, for instance, only imprisoned in the limited thought processes and limited or from egoistic motivations, we're not really doing those practices as they're meant to be done, because they're meant to be an opening to this reality. That's why we say the moment your forehead touches the ground, you're touching non-existence. You're awakening your own non-existence in order to be existent in that to which you're prostrating to. You're allowing yourself to disappear, at least your false self, your limited self, to disappear into that domain where you're one with all of existence. And even if it's only some moments during the day, it has an effect, it colors your whole being and will lead to more and more moments of that kind. The bottom line is that it's really something quite, in a way, simple, immediate, and available to us. And the alternative is the life of confusion, of information overload, of contradictory impulses, of a cramped soul that ignores its own freedom, even while we're being invited always to step outside of that prison of our own limited minds and emotional structures and constructed identity. So we had this theme that we've been also carrying since 2 weeks ago, and just to touch on that very briefly, the theme was offer your heart to God. I also suggested if you can come up with a better theme for yourself, by all means take it. But let's take this one for the moment. Offer your heart to God. Once again, it could sound a little bit like sentimental moralizing. But if we take it not as that, but as something that would be a learning experience, something that would orient us to give our heart a direction, and help us in a moment to see, well, what is my heart oriented to right at this moment? What is my heart filled with at this moment? What am I preoccupied with? In reality, the heart already belongs to God. In reality. But we play our games and we act otherwise. But let's perhaps keep this in mind and coming weeks and continue to ask, well, what would it be to offer my heart, to orient my heart towards the Divine Friend, to know that relationship, to trust that relationship, or to find that relationship. Now, I know when we, one last clarification, I know when we put it that way, it makes it sound, and there's a danger of making it sound, as if there's me and there's this God. Just as I construct a false self through my thoughts, I can also construct a false God. A God with just a great big personality, sort of like I have a little personality, he's got a huge personality. I'm a little person, he's a huge person. just as I've constructed my own false self, I may, and with all good intention, construct a false God, a mere concept of the divine, and offer my heart to that. But that's different than, as in the prostration, or as in your zikr, or as in the deepest contemplation, allowing the limitations of the false self to disappear, to merge into, and to experience oneness. To experience yourself as a reflection of that oneness, and a reflection of that divinity. Not the divinity entirely itself, but a reflection. So I hope there's something practical in all these words that have been spoken, something that can be applied and understood gradually. My experience is that these words are not understood immediately. That we need to hear them again and again in order to learn from them, in order to apply them, and in order to discover what's real in them for ourselves. Any thoughts or reflections or questions or confusions? Yes, sir.
Yesterday I had an experience that was more than subtle. I was with a friend and I had the opportunity to say something that was smart aleck. And only in retrospect did I see that it might have been somewhat hurtful. At the time I didn't, but I did have the inclination, and I believe it's because of our practice on other things, not practice that said, watch every word you say, bite your tongue, think before you speak, which is not been a habit of mine. And yet, in this instance, I paused before the words hit my lips, and I said something really loving. And I'm deeply grateful for that. Like I say, that's more than subtle. That's a change in my life. Not isolated.
Thank you. That's a beautifully described and beautifully observed, and it's also a very appropriate example of what we're talking about tonight, which is a spaciousness that's opening up beyond and around the thinking mind. Before, you were nothing but that smart aleck. Now the soul is expanding. And there might be room for that smart aleck now and then within this greater context. You never know. But to catch yourself, as you said, before hurting somebody's feelings or saying something inappropriate, it also was in this description, wasn't it?
The courtesy, bridling your tongue. Yeah, better, I don't know the words, but yeah.
So you have lived.
And it wasn't painful in the least.
It's a joy.
It wasn't. There was no should about it.
Right. No, it's not moralizing, and it's not.
It was just a higher part of me said, well, wait just a minute. Could we say something else? It didn't chastise the part that was going to say the other.
Yeah, beautiful.
Thank you for it. Thank you both.
Thank you. You're the one who lived it. I think my mind has been lately on, we have a beautiful tradition, and our tradition has its sources, its, shall we say, its its clothing, metaphorically speaking, and its framework and its references, and all of it is very beautiful and we love it. But sometimes I feel so much the urge, the need, to just explain these things in the most practical terms to where we could, not just for Sufis, not for people who are come with this perspective that we already have, but how can we, what we're talking about here, these are not matters of faith, they're not matters of belief, they're not matters that are belong exclusively to one lineage or tradition. They really are about the nature of grace and how it operates in the world, the nature of reality. Someone might more easily accept the word reality than the word grace. But one can, by experiencing the reality, experience the grace and be changed by it. If Richard Dawkins could for a moment get out of his compulsive thought processes, he might open up into a softer, kinder, more spacious reality, for instance. Well, Richard Dawkins is a very prominent, he's more than an atheist. An atheist one could easily respect. He's more of a, he's a British intellectual who is always demonizing people of faith, and especially Muslims, in the name of science. Mm. In the name of science. But a very poorly understood science. But one British magazine, not to harp on it, but one British magazine named him one of the top most influential thinkers in today's world. He is influential.
Rebecca, you had something you wanted to say?
Well, I'm happy to be back among you. And today, in the morning, I was doing meditation. It was to simply just let go of any worry and be in that, just to see what was, to be in that grace. And so as the day went along, I opened your book, which is one of the things I like to do in the morning, and actually the other day was I had opened it to this one. So all day long it's as if the whole day has unfolded to be here. Mm-hmm. One thing that happened was I had this whole checklist of going to the bank and okay, I paid my bills and did I have enough money to cover it all? Anyway, there's a teller there. And I like her name's Maya, and her hair is long and black, and it was like her makeup. And somehow we were doing all the business, and I said, oh, I just read the most wonderful thing the other day, and I just feel like I have to say it. Like, oh. And I couldn't remember it all. So I said, she had to do something with my account. I'll run to the car and get it. So I went to the car, got this book, came back. She was still, doing her calculations. And so I said, this is fascinating to me. This is just fascinating. And I've been reading it daily for about the past 3 days. And I opened it the other day. I was leaving a message for Eleanor, actually. Mm-hmm. And I just, and this is so, so in what you read tonight, and along with this, the big over question I've been studying since I was at Garrison, do you have the discipline to be a free spirit? And something in there, it's like the shackles, that word, like you said, it implies something harsh, but it doesn't necessarily, like discipline, like the disciple, who do you follow? So, in thinking about that, and then I just opened this, and this reminds me. Should I
read?
Please.
So it's page 246. True life. That ocean of the pearls and diamonds. True life. When did two prophets ever oppose each other? When did one ever try to wrestle the other's miracles away from him? Though the ego may be wise and clever, its aim is this world, so consider it as dead. Yet, when the water of God's inspiration reaches that dead one, the living one arises from the body's tomb. But until that inspiration comes, don't be fooled by the rouge of "May your life be long." Seek the celebration and remembrance that doesn't die, the resplendence of the sun that doesn't set. And there's the water and the... it reminded me of it when you said that the one hand, the two hands washing, when the two prophets ever oppose each other. Anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Rumi's always pointing to that. Everything he writes is about this one subject, which is...
I should go on just a little bit more in that. When I came back and read this to Maya, standing in the bank, her eyes got really big and she said, "Oh, Rumi, thank you so much. I love Rumi." She said, "Did you know it's from my culture?" I said, "No, I knew you came from Europe." She said, she's from somewhere, like Bosnia, somewhere right in there. And she said, "We were ruled for 200 years by the Turks, and yet I'm not part of that oppression. I'm part of a Muslim family that loves Rumi, and this is how we live." And that's that was a grace that fell on me today. I invited her to come tonight because she was amazed that there was such a group, but she couldn't come this night. I hope she...
Bring her another time. I'd love to meet her. Well, that's, you know, your impulse to share was right. It was appropriate. It's actually one of the themes of our recent retreat at Garrison last weekend was a verse of the Quran that I've also loved, which is simply, how does it go? "And of your, and of the blessings of your sustainer, share them," or declare them, or express them. But "share" is actually probably the best translation. So we're enjoined, whatever the blessings are that come to us spiritually, we're enjoined to share them. And that can be through silence, it can be through being, or it can be through crazy moments like this, of running out to the car and grabbing the door and coming back. You know, just following your heart. Bless you for doing that. It's following your inner knowing.
I guess she was supposed to be here. Like you know, you said you've invited her. Mm-hmm. So I guess she was supposed to be here, and that's why all of that happened.
She was thirsty, and the water was looking for her.
So this is more evidence that what we seek is seeking us all the time. That it is in the nature of existence, the nature of true reality, that we should be in communication with it, we should listen to it, because it is speaking to us, and sometimes we speak back. Alhamdulillah.